Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial meeting. Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Israel, Missouri. Law Hour is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on economic meltdown coming right after this. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it. A Budweiser six-pack is taxed 43%, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. But what is it that government does to produce, prepare, or deliver, for which government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the guy in the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on that pizza that he has to buy the ingredients to make, prepare, cook, serve, and pay rent on the store that you sit in to eat it? Why is it that government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that you and I buy? If you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Our tax and status school is available on compact disc for adult home education if you're online. Why don't you go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we took a look at a section from The Privateer, a bi-monthly newsletter, economics newsletter, comes out of Queensland, Australia. I have been reviewing the international forecaster for you, and I picked up, I mentioned last time, on kitco.com. I picked up four or five good articles free of charge. So don't say that, well, I can't afford these newsletters because they're just too expensive. And if you don't have a computer and you're just listening to me on the radio and you don't have a computer, surely you must know somebody who has a computer. There's got to be somebody out there somewhere in radio land who owns a computer. Go to your buddy Bob and say, Bob, there's some outfit called Kitco, K-I-T-C-O, and I can go to kitco.com. And there's a fellow on there by the name of Paul Van Eden. He writes, I think, every week, but if it's not every week, it's two or three times a month anyway. And Paul Van Eden wrote a seven-page article. It's actually a citation or a reproduction of a speech given by Ron Paul. Now, Ron Paul is a hard money advocate in the House of Representatives. He's a representative from Texas. Can anything good come out of Texas? Well, there's one good thing, Ron Paul of Texas. And Paul Van Eden had this to say. He said, I rarely report on someone else's work, but the speech given by the Honorable Ron Paul on February the 15th, 2006, before the U.S. House of Representatives deserves to be circulated to as wide an audience as possible. Some of you may have already read it. If you haven't, you should. Congressman Ron Paul of Texas is important. He's important to me, at least, because he is an advocate of liberty, hard money, something that is unfortunately very rare in Washington these days, and it is ironic that in a country built on the principle of liberty, there are so few who even know what liberty means. So if you don't know who Ron Paul is, I suggest you visit his website at www.house.government/Paul, P-A-U-L. So if you go to www.house.gov/Paul, there's Representative Ron Paul. Honorary Ron Paul of Texas, before the U.S. House of Representatives, February 15, 2006, and a speech that he called The End of Dollar Hegemony. 100 years ago, it was called dollar diplomacy after World War II, and especially after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, that policy evolved into dollar hegemony. But after all of these many years of great success, our dollar dominance is coming to an end. It has been said, rightly, that he who holds the gold makes the rules. In earlier times, it was readily accepted that fair and honest trade required an exchange of something of real value. First, it was simply barter of goods. Then it was discovered that gold held a universal attraction, and it was a convenient substitute for more cumbersome barter transactions. Not only did gold facilitate exchange of goods and services, it served as a store of value for those who wanted to save for a rainy day. And though money developed naturally in the marketplace, as governments grew in power, they assumed monopoly control over money and money supplies. Sometimes, governments succeeded in guaranteeing the quality and the purity of gold, but in time, governments learned to outspend their revenues. New or higher taxes always incurred the disapproval of the people, so it wasn't long before kings and Caesars learned how to inflate their currencies by reducing the amount of gold in each coin, always hoping that their subjects wouldn't discover the fraud. But the people always did, and they strenuously objected. This helped to pressure the leaders to seek more gold by conquering other nations. The people became accustomed to living beyond their means and enjoyed the circuses and the bread produced and financed and put on by their governments. Financing extravagancies by conquering foreign lands seemed a logical alternative to working harder and producing more. Besides, conquering nations not only brought home gold, they brought home slaves as well. Taxing the people in conquered territories also provided an incentive to build empires. This system of government worked well for a while, but the moral decline of the people led to an unwillingness to produce for themselves. There was a limit to the number of countries that could be sacked for their wealth, and this always brought empires to an end. When gold no longer could be obtained, their military might crumble, and in those days, those who held the gold truly wrote the rules and lived very well. That general rule has held fast throughout the ages. When gold was used and the rules protected honest commerce, productive nations thrived. Whenever wealthy nations, those with powerful armies and gold, strived only for empire and easy fortunes to support welfare at home, those nations failed. Today, the principles are the same, but the process is quite different. Gold no longer is the currency of the realm. Paper now is. The truth now is that he who prints the money makes the rules, at least for the time being. Although gold is not used, the goals are the same. Compel foreign countries to produce and subsidize the country with military superiority and control over the monetary printing presses. Since printing paper money is nothing short of counterfeiting, the issuer of the international currency must always be the country with the military might to guarantee control over the system. This magnificent scheme seems the perfect system for obtaining perpetual wealth for the country that issues the de facto world currency. The one problem, however, is that such a system destroys the character of the counterfeiting nation's people, just as was the case when gold was the currency and it was obtained by conquering other nations. And this destroys the incentive to save and the incentive to produce, while encouraging debt and runaway welfare. The pressure at home to inflate the currency comes from the corporate welfare recipients, as well as those who demand handouts as compensation for their needs and perceived injuries by others. In both cases, personal responsibility for one's actions are totally rejected. When paper money is rejected, or when gold runs out, wealth and political stability are lost. The country then must go from living beyond its means to living beneath its means until the economic and political systems adjust to the new rules. Rules no longer written by those who ran the now defunct printing presses. Dollar diplomacy, a policy instituted by William Howard Taft and his Secretary of State, Philander C. Knox, was designed to enhance U.S. commercial investments in Latin America and the Far East. William McKinley concocted a war against Spain in 1898, and Teddy Roosevelt's corollary to the Monroe Doctrine preceded Taft's aggressive approach to using the U.S. dollar and diplomatic influence to secure U.S. investments abroad. This earned the popular title of dollar diplomacy. The significance of Roosevelt's change was that our intervention now could be justified by the mere appearance that a country of interest to us was politically or fiscally vulnerable to European control. Not only did we claim a right, but even an official U.S. government obligation to protect our commercial interests from the Europeans. This new policy came on the heels of the gunboat diplomacy of the late 19th century, and it meant that we could buy influence before resorting to the threat of force. By the time the dollar diplomacy of William Howard Taft was clearly articulated, the seeds of American empire were planted, and they were destined to grow in the fertile political soil of a country that lost its love and respect for the republic bequeathed to us by the authors of our Constitution. And indeed they did. It wasn't very long before dollar diplomacy became dollar hedge money in the second half of the 20th century. This transition only could have occurred with a dramatic change in monetary policy and the nature of the dollar itself. Congress created the Federal Reserve System in 1913. Between then and 1971, the principle of sound money was systematically undermined. Between 1913 and 1971, the Federal Reserve found it much easier to expand the money supply at will for financing war or manipulating the economy with little resistance from Congress, while benefiting the special interests that influence government and government spending. After dominance got a huge boost after World War II, we were spared the destruction that so many other nations had suffered, and our coffers were filled with the world's gold. But the world chose not to return to the discipline of the gold standard, and the politicians applauded. Printing money to pay the bills was a lot more popular than taxing or restraining unnecessary spending. In spite of the short-term benefits, imbalances were institutionalized for decades to come. The 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement solidified the dollar as the preeminent world reserve currency, replacing the British pound. Due to our political and military muscle, and because we had a huge amount of physical gold, the world readily accepted our dollar, defined as 1/35th of an ounce of gold, as the world's reserve currency. The dollar was said to be as good as gold, and convertible to all foreign central banks at that rate of 1/35th of an ounce of gold to the dollar. For American citizens, however, gold remained illegal to own. There was a gold exchange standard that from inception was doomed to fail. The United States did exactly what many predicted that she would do. America printed more dollars for which there was no gold backing. But the world was very content to accept those dollars for more than 25 years with little or no question, until the French and others in the late 1960s began to demand that we fulfill our promises to pay 1 ounce of gold for each $35 that they delivered to the United States Treasury. Now, this resulted in a huge gold drain that brought an end to a very poorly devised pseudo-gold standard. It all ended on August the 15th, 1971, when President Nixon closed the gold window and refused to pay out any of our remaining 280 million ounces of gold. In essence, we declared our insolvency, and everyone recognized some other monetary system had to be devised in order to bring stability to the markets around the world. So amazingly, a new system was devised which allowed the United States to operate the printing presses for the world reserve currency with no restraints placed upon it. Not even a pretense of gold convertibility. None. Though the new policy was even more deeply flawed, it nevertheless opened the door for dollar hegemony to spread around the world. Realizing the world was embarking upon something new and mind-boggling, elite money managers, with especially strong support from United States authorities, struck an agreement with OPEC to produce and to price oil in U.S. dollars exclusively for all worldwide transactions. This gave the dollar a special place among world currencies and, in essence, backed the dollar with oil. So oil became what gold had been in previous centuries, the real substance behind the currency. In return, the United States promised to protect the various oil-rich kingdoms in the Persian Gulf against threat of invasion or domestic coup. This arrangement helped ignite the radical Islamic movement among those who resented our influence in the Middle East. The arrangement gave the dollar artificial strength with tremendous financial benefits for the United States. It allowed us to export our monetary inflation by buying oil and other goods at a great discount as dollar influence flourished worldwide. This post-Bretton Woods system was much more fragile than the system that existed between 1945 and 1971. Though the dollar-oil arrangement was helpful, it was not nearly as stable as the pseudo-gold standard under the Bretton Woods Agreement. It certainly was less stable than the gold standard of the late 19th century. During the 1970s, the dollar nearly collapsed as oil prices surged and gold skyrocketed to $800 an ounce. By 1979, interest rates of 21% were required to rescue the system. The pressure on the dollar in the 1970s, in spite of the benefits accrued to it, reflected reckless budget deficits and monetary inflation during the 1960s. The markets were not fooled by Lyndon Johnson's claim that we could afford both guns and butter. Once again, the dollar was rescued, And this ushered in the age of true dollar hegemony, lasting from the early 1980s to the present, with tremendous cooperation coming from the central banks and international commercial banks. The dollar was accepted as if it were, in fact, gold. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, on several occasions before the House Banking Committee, answered my challenges to him about his previously held favorable views on gold by claiming that he and other central bankers had gotten paper money, for example, the dollar system, to respond as if it were, in fact, gold. And each time I strongly disagreed, and I pointed out that if they had achieved such a feat, they would have defied centuries of economic history regarding the need for money to be something of real value. He smugly and confidently concurred with this. Now, in recent years, central banks and various financial institutions, all with vested interests in maintaining a workable fiat dollar standard, were not secretive about selling and loaning large amounts of gold to the market, even while decreasing gold prices, raised serious questions about the wisdom of such a policy. They never admitted to gold price fixing, but the evidence is abundant that they believed that if the gold price fell, it would convey a sense of confidence to the market, confidence that they indeed had achieved amazing success in turning paper into gold. Increasing gold prices historically are viewed as an indicator of distrust in paper currency. This recent effort was not a whole lot different than the U.S. Treasury selling gold at $35 an ounce in the 1960s in an attempt to convince the world that the dollar was sound and as good as gold. Even during the Depression, one of Roosevelt's first acts was to remove free market gold pricing as an indication of a flawed monetary system by making it illegal for American citizens to own gold. Economic law eventually limited that effort, as it did in the early 1970s, when our Treasury and the International Monetary Fund tried to fix the price of gold by dumping tons of gold into the market to dampen the enthusiasm of those seeking a safe haven for a falling dollar after gold ownership was re-legalized. Once again, the effort between 1980 and 2000 to fool the market as to the real value of the dollar proved to be totally unsuccessful. In the past 5 years, the dollar has been devalued in terms of gold by more than 50%. You just cannot fool all of the people all of the time, even with the power of the mighty printing press. Now, even with all of the shortcomings of the fiat monetary system, dollar influence thrived through the 1980s and 90s, and the results seemed very beneficial. But very gross distortions built into the system remained. And true to form, Washington politicians are only too anxious to solve the problems cropping up with window dressing, while failing to understand the real problems and then deal with the underlying flawed policy. Protectionism, fixing exchange rates, punitive tariffs, politically motivated sanctions, corporate subsidies, international trade management, price controls, interest rate and wage controls, supranationalist sentiments, threats of force, and even war are resorted to, and all to solve the problems artificially created by deeply flawed monetary and economic systems, in short, paper currencies. In the short run, the issuer of a fiat reserve currency can accrue great economic benefits. In the long run, it poses a threat to that country that is issuing the world currency. In this case, that's the United States of America. And as long as foreign countries take our dollars in return for real goods, we come out ahead. This is a benefit mainly in Congress. This is a benefit that many of us in Congress fail to recognize as they bash China for maintaining a positive trade balance with the United States. But this leads to a loss of manufacturing jobs to these overseas markets. We call this outsourcing, as we become more dependent upon these foreign nations and less self-sufficient. Foreign countries accumulate our dollars due to their high savings rates and then graciously loan them back to us at low interest rates to finance our excessive consumption. It sounds like a great deal for everyone, except the time will come when our dollars, due to their depreciation, will be received less enthusiastically or even be rejected by these very same foreign countries. That could create a whole new ballgame and force us to pay a price for living beyond our means and beyond our production. The shift in sentiment regarding the dollar has already started, but the worst is yet to come. Now, hang on, boys and girls, we've got to take a break right here. This is an address to the Congress of the United States by Representative Ron Paul, and it was reported in the Paul Van Eden newsletter called The End of Dollar Hegemony, published on the Kitco website by Kitco, www.kitco.com. It's called The Van Eden Report, and it was published February the 24th, 2006. If you'd like a copy of this report, you can get it from Representative Ron Paul's his website at www.paulvaneden.com. And that's spelled PaulVaneEden. There's two E's there. Now, Ron Paul also has a website. If you can't get it off of Van Eden or off of Kitco, go directly to www.house.gov/Paul/. And that'll give you Ron Paul's website. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour or editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about the economic meltdown. There is an inevitable cause and effect relationship that goes on in economics. It goes on in politics and social contexts and social services and so on. These cause and effect relationships are where the rubber meets the road. Throughout history, going back to ancient times, every nation and empire, every civilization has gone through the same traumatic events or the same traumas that we Americans are going through today. We're at war in Iraq and Iran, and not Iran yet, but it's coming, Iraq and Afghanistan, with future wars coming with Iran and Venezuela. And the reason that we can predict these future wars is because looking back through history, we can see this is what happened to the Roman empires when they got to the stage in their empire that we Americans are in our empire. We can see from the British experience, we can see from the Egyptians, from Alexander the Great, from ancient Babylon and Assyria. As we look at history, and as Edward Gibbons wrote back in the 18th century in his book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he listed 5 basic causes. He said this is what causes empires to collapse, to deteriorate from within. A moral decline comes from a monetary debasement, the decline of religion, and the increase of bribery and government graft and corruption. And when you take a look at what causes these five events to transpire, it is the debasement of the monetary system, which goes back to biblical times. It goes back to the law of God. It goes back to the law of Moses that says, thou shalt not steal. Governments steal by printing paper money. And they encourage you and I to steal when we use that paper money, which in biblical parlance is called unjust weights and balances, which are strictly prohibited in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16. Those two statutes, which are the supports or derive from the basic law that says thou shalt not steal, have penalties. There has to be a penalty for every broken law. If there were no penalties, then there would be no laws. And the law that says thou shalt not steal has a penalty. And the penalty is the loss of your property and property rights. And we Americans, when we embarked upon the Federal Reserve paper money scheme back in 1914, we began to steal. The ultimate end results of that theft process from 1914 until today has put us $49 trillion in debt. And that's what our federal government owes. The total, as of the last numbers that I saw, we Americans are buried under $149 trillion of debt, both public and private, and for commitments for the future. If you take a look at Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, veterans benefits, those are the things that we are committed to pay in the future. Then you take a look at our federal and our state budgets operating in deficits. That's our current account deficits. Then when you take a look at our mortgages and our car payments and our credit cards and all the rest of our debts, and you add all of those together, we owe $149 trillion. It's not something new. It's something that's been around since Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. It's the way the world works. Now, a representative named Ron Paul gave an address in the House of Representatives. He goes on to say, the agreement with OPEC in the 1970s to price oil in dollars has provided tremendous artificial strength to the dollar as the preeminent reserve currency, and this has created a universal demand for the dollar, and it soaks up the huge number of new dollars that are being generated every year. Last year alone, M3 increased over $700 billion. The artificial demand for our dollar, along with our military might, places us in the unique position to rule the world without productive work or savings, and without limits on consumer spending or deficits. The problem is, the question is, can it last? And the answer to that question is, no, it cannot last. Price inflation is raising its ugly head, and the NASDAQ bubble generated by easy money has burst. The housing bubble, likewise created, is deflating. Gold prices have doubled. The federal spending is out of sight with zero political will to rein it in. The trade deficit last year was over $728 billion. And a $2 trillion war is raging, and plans are being laid to expand that war into Iran and possibly Syria. The only restraining force will be the world's rejection of the dollar. It's bound to come and create conditions worse than we experienced in 1979 and 1980, which required 21% interest rates to correct. But everything possible will be done to protect the dollar in the meantime. We have a shared interest with those who hold our dollars to keep the whole charade going on forever. Now, Alan Greenspan, in his first speech after leaving the Federal Reserve, said that gold prices were up because of concern about terrorism and not because of monetary concerns or because he created too many dollars during his tenure as Federal Reserve Chairman. Gold has been and must be continuously discredited and the dollar propped up. Even when the dollar comes under serious attack by market forces, the central banks and the International Monetary Fund surely will do everything conceivable to soak up the dollars in hope of restoring stability and confidence. But eventually, that too will fail. Most importantly, the dollar-oil relationship has to be maintained to keep the dollar as a preeminent currency. Any attack on this relationship between oil and gold will be forcefully challenged, as it already has been in Iraq and will be in Syria. and in Iran, and if need be, in Venezuela. In November 2000, Saddam Hussein demanded euros for his oil. His arrogance was a threat to the dollar. His lack of any military might was never a threat. At the first cabinet meeting with the new administration in 2001, as reported by Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, the major topic of discussion was how we would get rid of Saddam Hussein, though there was no evidence whatsoever that he posed any threat to us. This deep concern for Saddam Hussein surprised and shocked O'Neill. It now is common knowledge that the immediate reaction of the administration after 9/11 revolved around how they could connect Saddam Hussein to the attacks to justify an invasion and the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein government in Iraq. Even with no evidence of any connection to 9/11 or evidence of weapons of mass destruction, public and congressional support was generated through distortions and flat-out misrepresentation of the facts to justify overthrowing Saddam Hussein. There was no public talk of removing Saddam Hussein because of his attack on the integrity of the dollar as a reserve currency by selling oil in euros. Many people believe this was the real reason for our obsession with Iraq, however. I doubt it was the only reason, but it may well have played a very significant role in our motivation to wage war against Iraq. Within a very short period after the military victory, all Iraqi oil sales were carried out in dollars, and the euro was abandoned. In 2001, Venezuela's ambassador to Russia spoke of Venezuela switching to the euro for all of their oil sales. Within a year, there was a coup attempt against Chavez, reportedly with assistance from our CIA. After these attempts to nudge the euro toward replacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency were met with resistance, the sharp fall of the dollar against the euro was reversed. These events may well have played a significant role in maintaining our dollar dominance. It is becoming more and more clear that the U.S. administration was sympathetic to those who plotted the overthrow of the Chavez government in Venezuela and was embarrassed by its failure. The fact that Chavez was democratically elected had very little influence on which side we supported. Now a new attempt is being made against the petrodollar system. Iran, another member of the Axis of Evil, has announced their plans to initiate an oil burst in March of this year. And guess what? The oil sales will be priced in euros, not dollars. Now, most Americans forget how our policies have systematically and needlessly antagonized the Iranians over the years. In 1953, the CIA helped to overthrow a democratically elected president. His name was Mohammad Mossadegh, and installed the authoritarian Shah, who was friendly to the United States. The Iranians were still fuming over this when the hostages were seized back in 1979. Our alliance with Saddam Hussein in his invasion of Iran in the early 1980s did not help matters, and they obviously did not do very much for our relationship with Saddam Hussein either. The administration announcement in 2001 that Iran was part of the Axis of Evil didn't do much to improve the diplomatic relationship between our two countries. And our recent threats over nuclear power, while ignoring the fact that they are surrounded by countries with nuclear weapons, doesn't seem to register with those who continue to provoke Iran, with what most Muslims perceive as our war against Islam. And this recent history, there's little wonder why Iran might choose to harm America by undermining the dollar. Iran, like Iraq, has zero capability to attack us. But that did not stop us from turning Saddam Hussein into a modern-day Hitler ready to take over the world. Now, Iran, especially since Iran has made plans for pricing oil in euros, has been on the receiving end of a propaganda war not unlike that waged against Iraq before our invasion. It is not likely that maintaining dollar supremacy was the only motivating factor for the war against Iraq, nor for agitating against Iran. Though the real reasons for going to war are complex, we now know that the reasons given before the war started, like the presence of weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein's connection to 9/11, were totally false. But the dollar's importance is so obvious. But this does not diminish the influence of the distinct plans laid out years ago by the neoconservatives to remake the Middle East. Israel's influence, as well as that of the Christian Zionists, likewise played a role in prosecuting this war. Protecting our oil supplies has influenced our Middle East policy for many decades. But the truth is that paying the bills for this aggressive intervention is impossible the old-fashioned way, that is, with more taxes, or with more savings, or with more production by the American people. Much of the expense of the Persian Gulf War in 1991 was shouldered by many of our willing allies. That's not so today. Now, more than ever, the dollar hegemony, its dominance as the world's reserve currency, is required to finance our huge war expenditures. This $2 trillion, this never-ending war, must be paid for, one way or another. Dollar hegemony provides the vehicle to do just that. For the most part, the true victims aren't even aware of how they pay the bills. The license to create money out of thin air allows the bills to be paid through price inflation. American citizens, as well as average citizens of Japan, China, and other countries, suffer from price inflation, which represents the tax that pays the bills for our military adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan. That is, until the fraud is finally discovered, and the foreign producers decide not to take these dollars, nor to hold these dollars very long in payment for their goods. Everything possible is being done to prevent the fraud of the monetary system from being exposed to the masses who suffer from it. If oil markets replace dollars with euros, it would in time curtail our ability to continue to print without restraint the world's reserve currency. It is an unbelievable benefit to us to import valuable goods and export depreciating dollars in return. The exporting countries have become addicted to our purchases for their economic growth. This dependency makes them allies in continuing the fraud, and their participation keeps the dollar's value artificially high. And if this system were workable long term, American citizens would never have to work again. We, too, could enjoy bread and circuses just as the Romans did, but their gold finally ran out, and the inability of Rome to continue to plunder conquered nations brought an end to the Roman Empire. And the same thing will happen to us if we do not change our ways. And though we don't occupy foreign countries to directly plunder, we, however, nevertheless have spread our troops across 130 nations of the world, and our intense effort to spread our power in the oil-rich Middle East is not a coincidence. But unlike the old days, we don't declare direct ownership of the natural resources. We just insist that we can buy what we want, and then we can pay for it with our paper money that we create off of our printing presses out of thin air. And any country that challenges our authority does so at great risk. And once again, Congress has bought into the war propaganda against Iran just as it did against Iraq. And arguments are now made for attacking Iran economically and militarily if it becomes necessary. These arguments are all based on the same false reasons given for the ill-fated and costly occupation of Iraq. Our whole economic system depends on continuing the current monetary arrangement, which means recycling the dollar is crucial. Currently, we borrow over $700 billion every year from our gracious benefactors who work hard and take our paper for their goods. In turn, we borrow all of the money we need to secure the empire. The Department of Defense budget, for instance, is $450 billion plus more to come. Now, the military might we enjoy becomes the backing of our currency. There are no other countries that can challenge our military superiority, and therefore they have little choice but to accept the dollars that we declare are today's gold. This is why countries that challenge the system, countries like Iraq, Iran, and Venezuela, become targets of our plans for regime change. Now, ironically, dollar superiority depends on our strong military, and our strong military depends upon our dollar. And as long as foreign recipients take our dollars for real goods and are willing to finance our extravagant consumption and militarism, the status quo will continue regardless of how huge our foreign debt and foreign account deficits become. But real threats come from our political adversaries who are incapable of confronting us militarily, yet are not bashful about confronting us economically. And that's why we see the new challenge from Iran being taken so seriously. The urgent arguments about Iran posing a military threat to the security of the United States are no more plausible than the false charges levied against Iraq. And yet there is no effort to resist this march to confrontation by those who grandstand for political reasons against the Iraq war. It seems that the people and Congress are easily persuaded by these preemptive war promoters, and it's only after the cost in human life and dollars are tallied up that the people begin to object to this unwise militarism. The strange thing is that the failure in Iraq is now apparent to a large majority of the American people, and yet they and the Congress are acquiescing to the call for a needless and dangerous confrontation with Iran. But then again, our failure to find Osama bin Laden and destroy his network did not dissuade us from taking on the Iraqis in a war totally unrelated to 9/11. Concern for pricing oil only in dollars helps explain our willingness to drop everything and to teach Saddam Hussein a lesson for his defiance in demanding euros in place of dollars for his oil. And once again, There's this urgent call for sanctions and threats of force against Iran at the precise time that Iran is opening a new oil exchange with all transactions to be denominated in euros. Using force to compel people to accept money without real value can only work in the short run. It ultimately leads to economic dislocation, both domestic and international, and it always ends with a price to be paid. The economic law that honest exchange demands only things of real value as currency cannot be repealed, and the chaos that one day will ensue from our 35-year experiment with worldwide fiat money will require a return to money of real value. We will know that day is approaching when oil-producing countries demand gold or its equivalent for their oil rather than dollars or euros. And the sooner we do that, the better for all of us. Now, that was an address by Representative Ron Paul to the House of Representatives in the Congress of the United States, one of the few people in America that makes sense. So get ready for war with Iran. It's coming. Get ready for war with Venezuela. Nothing personal. It's nothing personal. It's just money. That's the reason for the war in Iraq. And it will be the reason for war in Iran. And as these wars accelerate to preserve the status quo, you can expect the ultimate World War III. And boy, that will be the big one. Well, we're about out of time. We'll have to leave it right there. Let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information, just go to the webpage, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by pre-arrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.